Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Books and Beyond. Tonight, it's my pleasure to have as our guest Chris Keneally. Chris Keneally works for the Copyright Clearance Center, has written a book called Massachusetts 101, or The Massachusetts Legacy. He's written on travel, technology, and culture, and several other things, and writes for many national newspapers in large cities, and is also involved with a program called Beyond the Book, which airs occasionally on C-SPAN and on television in Canada as well. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Bonnie.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. How did you get involved with the Copyright Clearance Center?
Well, I should say just a little bit about what Copyright Clearance Center is,
yes,
and that will be a way to answer the question. We are online at copyright.com. The company was founded about 30 years ago, and it's a non-profit with a mission to help promote the value of intellectual property, mostly books and articles and journals and newspapers. And in 2001, they wanted to expand into working with individual authors. So the idea was to find somebody who understood the problems of individual authors. And boy, did I understand those problems, because I had been an individual author, still am in a way, but I had been a freelance writer for 15 years. And as I like to say, during that time, I ate what I killed. And I knew what it meant to be a writer and to try to make a living at it. So they asked me to work with them to develop programs and to really kind of think like an author and help them develop in ways that would benefit the individual authors. So I joined the company in September of 2001, and over the last 6+ years, we've developed a number of programs, the spearhead of which is what you refer to, and that's Beyond the Book, not to be confused with Books and Beyond.
Absolutely.
And we are at beyondthebook.com. For your audience, it would be helpful to know that this is a podcast series, so you can listen to the programs as well as get transcriptions and a host of other information. You can download them to iTunes if you have an iPod and listen to them at your leisure, or you can streamline them directly online. And they feature conversations with writers from a variety of backgrounds. We're currently leading up to our annual appearance at Book Expo. Book Expo America is the largest book fair, if you will, of its kind in the country this year, coming up at the end of May in Los Angeles. And for the last 2 years, we've done programs highlighting various areas of book publishing, and we're running segments of some of those programs in the coming weeks. So the podcast online this week is my conversation with David Marinus, who is a reporter and an editor with the Washington Post, who wrote a biography of Bill Clinton, but chatted with me about his fascinating biography of biographies of some sports figures. Vince Lombardi, for example, he's written the biography of Vince Lombardi, the famous Green Bay Packer football coach, and he also wrote a biography of Roberto Clemente, who, as we all know, died tragically on a flight to aid victims of an earthquake in his native country of Nicaragua. David's a fascinating, entertaining fellow, And as a writer, has few equals. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Bill Clinton. So it's been a tremendous opportunity for me to learn about the business inside and out, and to be able to share that information with people, authors, as well as the people they work with, the editors, the publishing executives, who, believe it or not, really still, to this day, need authors to give them the material that they're going to go publish. You know, it's a world of abundance when it comes to information and to what is usually known as content these days. But that doesn't mean that the value of the author has diminished all that much. If you're in the business, you still need these pesky people named authors, Bonnie, who actually create all this stuff. And my message to people who are writers or who, you know, hope one day to be writers is that they should persevere, because there really are people who want their work. And the main thing that I've learned is, as a writer, you know, when you're a kid, you might dream about millions of people reading your work. But frankly, it's even more true today. What success ought to be defined by is not by a million people reading your book if 999,990 of them don't care. If you get the 100 people or the 10 people or the 10,000 people who really care about what you have to say, or who are really interested in the subject you're writing about, that's what counts. And you will have a career if you can find them. But shooting for the million people isn't really a realistic goal. And it's not even actually a very worthwhile one. But trying to find the people who really care about what you want to say, who really care about what you have to write, that's what's important.
Well, I think it's even harder today, since there is so much more information, and information is being added to so frequently, and so quickly. It doubles and triples and quadruples over periods of time, and that changes everything.
Well, it's funny, I think, Bonnie. That's true, absolutely. It's, in one respect, harder than ever. In the other respect, it's easier. Because while certainly it's harder, the volume of material out there is so much greater. And yet, that doesn't say anything at all about the quality of what's out there. And so, if you think of it this way, well, it's harder because the volume is there. It's easier in a way because the more terrible stuff is out there, if you will, the more obvious the good stuff really becomes. If you're walking along the beach and it's nothing but grains of sand, what you will notice are the diamonds. You won't notice the grains of sand.
I think there's probably a lot to be said for that. You mentioned before that you understood the problems of an author. What are the problems of authors today?
Oh, my goodness.
I suppose
problems
that's as varied as the authors themselves, but what are some of them?
That's absolutely true. Well, I'll answer it from my own experience, and hopefully it'll resonate with people who are there. The problems start with finding the time to write and maintaining the dedication that you need to have to write. We all live extremely busy lives. Even when I was writing full-time and it was the only way I made a living, I was also running a business. And running a business, if you're a small business owner, whatever it is, perhaps 10% of it is the part that you really love, and the 90% of it is the part you can't stand, the bookkeeping, chasing people who owe you money, looking for the next sale, keeping the office clean, whatever it is. So it's extremely hard to actually do the thing that's most important, which is to write.
I'm sure.
It's never easy to get good ideas. I tell people I have two sources of ideas, Bonnie. One is I think of them, and the other is I steal them. And of course, I'm kidding about that last part. But what I mean is, by stealing ideas, is I'm always on the lookout for things that suggest themselves as opportunities to write or to pursue a study further. You can sit around and think about things. You can take a shower and think about things. You can drive the car to work or wherever you go, and think in that kind of time when nobody can bother you. And today, I think besides the car and the shower, there are a few places where people can really, where I should say you can keep people out, because with cell phones and everything else, people are always intruding. So the time to think, there's another problem, the time to think has gotten shorter and more scarce. But if you can think of your own ideas, that's great. If you can keep an eye out for where the culture is going, where the business is that you're following is going, where the issues that you care about are going, and you can follow it and hear what other people have to say, often they will inspire you and they will make you think of things. You sometimes think of things on your own, but a lot of the time you'll find a kind of clue to your next assignment. And I'm not sure of the audience here, but I'm going to presume to talk about what I know best, which is nonfiction. And whether that's about current events or history, which I've written about for Massachusetts, or whatever it is, reading is the fundamental way. And listening to news reports and getting your information from whatever sources, this is the fundamental way to figure out where you're going next. I used to say when people would offer to send me information of one kind or another as a freelancer, I could never have too much information. You're right, there's a lot of it out there, but you can almost never have too much because you get to decide what's important to you. You need to have that ability.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you know what? You shouldn't be ashamed of it. You know, if you have too much information and you don't use any of it, it hasn't gone to waste. You don't know when you might use it again, and you certainly... Really, you shouldn't feel sorry about it because it's not like wasting food. it's not like wasting energy. These are the things that matter. You waste food and somebody might go hungry. You waste energy and the planet might suffer. But if you waste information, Bonnie, I don't think anyone's going to know.
No, and they don't know what you have that you might use later.
Absolutely.
It's a matter of observation and discipline, too. I was struck by your idea that in a way, kiddingly, you said that in a way you steal ideas. But in a way, we do. If you sit down and write, and your idea comes through observation or even research, in a sense you are sort of borrowing or improving on or increasing the knowledge by writing what someone else has already written, and you're adding to it, but you're starting with through research what someone else has already put together.
Absolutely true. Absolutely. I absolutely agree. And that's what culture is about. None of us invented ourselves completely.
Absolutely. How would you, since you love history, obviously, and you know a lot about Massachusetts history and history in general, what would you do to create more interest in history for younger people? That seems to be one of the most difficult things for people to be able to do these days, because a lot of people say, well, that's in the past, it doesn't matter. Why does it matter, and how would you create or stimulate that interest?
It's a great question. The first thought I have is that, you know, people will say, oh, you know, history is so difficult, I hate history, it's all about names and dates.
Right.
And what I respond is, well, names and dates don't make history. People do. And people are fascinating. The history of Massachusetts, and your audience is potentially a global audience, so I hope they know Massachusetts. It's funny, I've had the very great opportunity to travel around the world. And you know, I wouldn't say I'm from Massachusetts necessarily. That might throw a few people. I might say I'm from Boston, and even that might throw a few people. But then I might say, well, I'm from Boston. That's where Harvard is. Now, technically
yes.
Speaking, Harvard isn't Cambridge. But my point is that the reputation of my home state is almost immediately tied for the world with this great institution of learning, which is Harvard. But to finish my answer to your question, recognize, everybody should recognize, whether you're trying to get your children interested in history, whether you're a teacher trying to get your students interested in history, or whether you yourself just think you should care more. Recognize that history is the accumulation of all these actions and events that have been precipitated by human beings, men and women throughout the ages, and they haven't changed. They're the same. You would recognize them as your neighbors, whether they were from Shakespeare's time or from Caesar's time or whatever. And it's, to me, really important to think of history as stories. So my book is a collection of short essays, but really more short narratives that try to tell a little story, an engaging story, where there's plenty of fact, and you learn the facts, but you learn the facts without realizing you're learning them, because hopefully you're engaged by the story, who these characters were, what the challenge was they faced, and how they responded as human beings to whatever it was, whether it was, you know, the revolution in 1776, whether it was fast-forwarding to our own time, and, for example, you know, to tie it back to education, Martin Luther King attended, we just were marking last week, the 40th anniversary of his assassination, but Martin Luther King attended a school, Boston University. He was an extraordinarily young man. I mean, people forget how young he was, Bonnie. I don't have it in front of me, but I think he was 43 years old when he was killed. He won the Nobel Prize. He was still in his late 30s.
Wow.
He began the civil rights movement with the bus boycott in Alabama, and I don't think he was yet 30 years old. He attended Boston University. He hadn't yet turned 20. He was a PhD candidate. He was a genius. We remember him as a great orator, as this great figure in political history. But the fact of the matter was, even had he never gone on to achieve all those great things, he would probably still have been an extraordinarily famous and successful man simply because of the sheer force of his intellect. Okay? And it was that that brought him to Massachusetts in the late 1950s to study at Boston University, where he absorbed the lessons of nonviolent opposition to political oppression through Gandhi and Thoreau's examples and so forth. Just think that that's a great story. Think about that. A young man from a background tremendously different from the typical Bostonian of his day arrives at a university with some great mission burning in his heart, which is to help his people free themselves from oppression. He's still a boy, really, a young man, a teenager nearly,
yes.
And comes to the city of Boston for the single reason of wanting an education. That's a great story. We can all immediately picture this young man who becomes the great figure of Martin Luther King, but at one moment is simply getting off a bus or a train and coming to school for the first day.
In a way, what he went through is, I'm sure, in all ways, he could understand what it was like to be the first, because he was out alone on a limb doing that, just as the students that, the black students who went to schools with white children for the first time went.
That's a very good point. And sometimes being first, you know, we look back on being first, and we think of it as a great achievement, but sometimes being first, going first, can be the most frightening thing to do. You know, whenever you're in class, when you're in school, and, you know, the teacher wants everybody in the room to recite a poem or whatever, it's always the hardest to go first. It's always the hardest to go first in a game. It's always the hardest to go first so many other ways. And so someone like King, you know, to be the first, it must have required a great amount of courage.
And you have to be willing to make the commitment to being a groundbreaker and have a resolve within yourself to want to do that and stay committed to it.
And, right, and maybe even you have to be ready to fail.
Yes.
And I think that there's a lesson in that as well for writers. You asked about the problems that writers face. You're going to fail more often than you're going to succeed. This is not baseball. And even in baseball, you know, a team is a great team when it's just slightly better than a 500 team, you know, 500 average, right? So we just started the baseball season. Opening day at Fenway Park was just yesterday. But a good baseball team out of the 162 games wins 85, 90 games. So they do just better than winning more than half the games. If you're a writer, you are enormously successful, I would say, if you can get one out of the four assignments you're after. Chasing work as a freelance writer, writing proposals for books, the chances of being rejected are far greater than the chances of being accepted. And everyone needs to recognize that and not take it terribly personally.
Yes, just as you have to realize that when you're, for instance, in a writer's group, you can't take critiquing personally either. It isn't personally about you. It's just about your writing.
That's true. Absolutely. Absolutely true. And if you did take it personally, it would stop you dead in your tracks, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. One of the things we have today, I think, is an awful lot of sensitivity in the world. People take things too personally and too seriously. What can authors do to better impress agents and editors and to put their best foot forward, so to speak? Is there specific advice that you would give writers on how to do
that?
Well,
things have changed in that regard. It used to be when you were submitting a proposal, and I say used to be, I mean maybe 10 years ago, that long ago, which is, I'm making a joke, not that long.
No.
You would send a package in the mail, examples of your work. Today, if an editor receives a proposal, he or she is going to get that proposal probably by email. The first thing they're going to do is Google you. So every writer, everyone who wants to be a writer, should know what it looks like when you Google yourself. It may show you to, first of all, it's a positive because if you are proposing to write a book about long-distance running, and if you Google your name and you find out that you've been a marathon runner and have placed in the top 10, you know, the last 10 marathons you entered, right? The editor will find out that, well, this person may well know what they're talking about because he or she has run in 10 or 15 marathons and never done worse than 10th place. On the other hand, you may be proposing whatever project and not be telling the editor about some checkered moment in your past where you had been caught embezzling from your last employer. Right?
Right.
And so what you need to know is that the very first thing that any editor is going to do is to Google you.
Find all.
And
they'll find all.
Absolutely. So, you know, bear that in mind as a positive message. I mean, we think of that and we think, oh my God, they're going to find out, you know, all these terrible things about me. We hear stories about, you know, college students who aren't really thinking very clearly, and they put silly photographs or information about all the parties they attend, and then some potential employer finds out that this is the kind of person they are. Think about that beforehand.
Some writers have learned to their
their dismay, right?
Yes,
but then also think about the advantage, because even before you're proposing a book, if you are doing a blog or doing some of the work that you and people involved with this project are doing, and you've built the community and you have people who care about what you do, that will be uncovered by that search. So
yeah.
We'll know that Bonnie is associated with Accessible World, and she's associated with Books and Beyond, and she's associated with this project or that project. So that if what I'm looking for is the qualifications that make you, if I'm an editor, the right person to do that book, that will be apparent. And it will also be apparent to me that there might even be people out there ready to buy the book when it comes out. While the web can uncover your deepest, darkest secrets, it can also show an editor or anyone else that you are absolutely the right person to be doing this book, and that if we publish this book, it will be successful because hundreds or thousands or whatever is the number of people already know and trust Bonnie as the source for information on whatever the subject is.
Well, what you're saying is that things are not nearly as insular as they used to be. It's much more of a global, it's got much more of a global feel to it.
Right. And that what we do is, a couple of times we've said this already, oh, there's too much information. Well, there's too much information, but the positive part of that is that in that environment where it's all sand on the beach, the diamonds are the things that are going to become most obvious. In an environment where anybody at all can find out about you, we think, oh my God, then they're going to know that, I placed 10th in the spelling bee back in second grade. Yes, they'll find that out. But they'll also find out that you won the Olympic 100-meter freestyle. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a positive to all of this because the information is there immediately. The negative exists. I don't want to minimize it. But at the same time, it's still true that people will find out about you much more easily, much more immediately, and you hope the way that you want to be seen.
What do you think authors would like readers and publishers to know about what they do?
I think what an author should want a publisher to know is that they are the right person to do that book or to do that article. Publishers have to make choices. When they choose to give you an assignment or to give you an advance for a book, to give you a contract for a book, they are making an investment in you as a writer. And so what you as the author want is to convince the publisher that that investment's going to return a dividend for them.
Salesmanship.
Well, that's right, but also... it's a kind of a sale, but it's a more immediate. Oh, sorry, it's a more long term than immediate sale.
Sure.
Right, because if you're trying to sell somebody something, you really don't care what happens once they've paid you the money and walked away. But if you're talking about a relationship, and that's really what you're talking about, because as an author, you would prefer to have a long term relationship with the publisher, and you would also prefer to have a long-term relationship with the reader than the short-term thing. If all you care about is having them buy the book, that's fine, and I suppose it works if you get enough of sales. But I think that a real a committed author is going to care about the relationship, because whether you're writing an article or writing a book, the publisher who's going to make the decision to work with you the first time, you want them to work with you the second time, the third time, and the tenth time. Likewise, it's about reputation when it comes to the reader. You know, if I recognize the name, I trust that person. You see what I mean? It's the relationship. So I would say that always think about how this is going to reflect on you as the author. You know, is the publisher going to trust you to do the work? Are you going to be on time? Are you going to write what you said you were going to write? Are you going to deliver a manuscript that's actually yours and not something you stole? That kind of thing. And when it comes to the reader, are you going to deliver a story that's compelling, that's well-researched, that fulfills the promise of the headline? You know, if you're a newspaper article writer, the headline sort of promises something. And then you as the reader start to read it and you think, well, it's not answering the questions I have. If it doesn't do that, then the next time they see your name, they'll say, well, the last time I read that article by him, he didn't really do the job. So think about relationships, and I would say you'd be more successful.
I think that has to happen in a good interview, too. And you're right about authors. I was thinking as you were answering that question that the most successful authors seem to be the ones who have longtime agents and publishers. Mary Higgins Clark and Ann Rule both came to my mind, and they both do.
Well, that's true. And frankly, even as a freelance journalist, you know, my own work, I was very lucky because when I began to write as a young man, I worked with editors at local newspapers who themselves then went to the next level of publication. So they went, say, from the Boston Business Journal to writing, or to editing, I should say, for the Boston Globe. And when they made that move, they then said, oh, well, I used to work with Keneally at the Boston Business Journal, now I want to work with him at the Boston Globe. So it's that kind of relationship that extends over time. So like the, as you say, you know, the authors who work with agents for long periods of time, you could also imagine yourself working with editors for long periods of time, because you don't know. The editor you're working with at the Columbus, what's the paper in Columbus? I should know. Okay, well, it's the Cleveland, it's the Inquirer in Cleveland, or what is
Cleveland
it?
Plain Dealer.
The Cleveland Plain Dealer.
Mm-hmm.
So the editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer may wind up someday as the editor of the New York Times and may take you along with him or her as they move up that ladder.
Right.
And that's critical as well. So, again, it's a relationship business, and trust is really where it's at. It's almost like politics. The figures who keep getting elected as they move up the ladder have earned trust, so that even when they were just dog catcher, Bonnie,
That's right.
They did a good job as dog catcher.
Well, you have to care about that job as much as you care about any other.
Absolutely. And, so then they move along up the line until finally they're running for president of the United States. But they've built a reputation. They've been reliable for certain kinds of things. They've delivered on the promises they've made. And they've cared about what people think. And I think writers ought to do the same.
Let's talk about...
This is very interesting, I have to say, because it's very philosophical. We're having a very philosophical discussion. But it's important because, you know, I mean, writing is not a science. It is like politics. It's an art, you know?
It is. I was about to say that. Let's talk about interviewing for a moment, Chris, since you do that and I do that. What do you think makes you a successful interviewer, or are the elements of a good interview?
I think a good interviewer, people think, well, you have to know how to ask the right question. Absolutely. But you also have to know how to listen well. And you have to let people answer the question. Sometimes if you're, you know, we've just been through some hearings the last few days where various congresspeople have had an opportunity to ask General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker about what's happening in the war. And they've clearly had axes to grind, and they've clearly had, you know, points that they've wanted to make. That's not a typical interview.
Right.
A typical interview for a journalist is an opportunity to really listen well. You have to be able to focus the questions so that they're going to provide you with an answer that's informative. You can't just say, so, how did you get the idea for this book? That's not a good enough answer question, because the answer can go anywhere. But if you focus it well enough, then you're going to get an answer that's informative, engaging, enlightening. But it really does come down to listening. you can't just ask the question and let them buzz away with some noise for a while and then ask the next question. You have to respond. The conversation has to grow, has to climb the way somebody climbs a ladder or moves along a scale or something like that. And I learned that most when I was a TV reporter, because TV sometimes is about capturing people when they're at their most unguarded moment. When people have been told they're being interviewed by a television reporter, that seems especially concerning to them. They want to be very careful. And so what you need to do is to ask the question, let them answer, and when they think they've finished the answer, don't say anything. Just be quiet. And they will fill in that little gap, and they'll keep going. And that's often when they say the honest thing. You know what I mean? First they've given you the answer that they prepared.
Then they give you the real one.
And then they give you the real one, exactly.
I read that in a novel recently, of all things.
Really?
In which there was a reporter, and he told someone, in order to get information, that's exactly what they should do, because he said the person will feel like they have to fill in the gap, and the person tried it, and it worked. I believe
Absolutely.
In it, too.
Absolutely. And because the camera's rolling, people think they have to keep talking. They think that silence is wrong. So they'll keep filling the air.
Well, silence is the modern version of evil.
Right. It's true. And what you just said was absolutely true, and I'm going to steal that idea. First they give you the prepared answer, then they give you the real one. That's it in a nutshell.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Who do you admire? People often ask me before I started doing this show, they would say, well, you know, have you listened to any book shows, and is there anyone you admire? And I certainly had heard of Fresh Air and other shows, and listened to them from time to time. But I have always believed that you really have to develop your own style, because the point is to engage the person that you're interviewing and to engage yourself in what you're doing and to elicit the passion that a person feels for what they've done. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're asking if I have... any heroes?
Actually, I am.
You know, I admire more than ever. I mean, in Beyond the Book, there have been times when we've done programs 2 hours long, live television.
Mm.
We will get a little break in the middle between the first hour and the second hour. First hour will be the interviews with the authors. Second hour will be a managed question and answer session. And I'm telling you, by the end of those 2 hours of live television, Bonnie, I feel as if I have run a marathon. It's exhausting. It's exhilarating, but
intense.
It's exhausting.
And intense concentration, too.
Exactly, because you can't lose the train of thought. You know, your audience is expecting you to make the connections all along the way, and you're their guide. And that's an enormous responsibility. And if you screw up and you get lost, you feel as if you've led an entire party of Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, you know, into the woods somewhere, and you have no idea where you're going. In that regard, you know, frankly, I think the people on NPR do a terrific job, some better than others. I think Charlie Rose is to be admired for being able to talk one day about politics and the next day about Shakespeare. I don't see everybody or hear everybody. So I'm going to leave out people who deserve, to be credited with their own particular abilities. You know, it does come down to taste as well. Over time, you begin to identify with the person who's asking the questions. when you have a program like the one you do, like the one I try to do, or even NPR, you know, the consistent figure is always the interviewer. And if that person, if you trust them, again, it's a relationship.
Yes.
If you trust them, if you think they are sincere, if you think they really have done the work, and you rely on them to kind of always be at least a half a step ahead of you. And if they do maintain that, then I think, you know, you're going to come back and listen to them again and again, and they'll have earned your trust. So a really good interviewer is somebody who the reader trusts. And I think also the person who is speaking with them trusts them too. If you get the idea that somebody's up to no good as an interviewer, is trying to catch you at something or trying to make you say something you don't want to say, then you're on your guard and you're not going to be honest. You're not going to give the real answer, as you point out, to the real question. And so you get a lot of drivel.
People don't want their passion undersold either. I was thinking that one of the reasons it's not a good idea to ask a question, the example that you gave earlier, why did you write this book, or how did you come to write this book? You could be setting yourself up for the trap of someone very flippantly saying, and yet very deliberately saying, well, because I wanted to. And which leaves you in a very bad place as an interviewer.
Right, because you've lost control of the situation. Maintaining control, it sounds like a harsh thing, but in fact, as an interviewer, it's absolutely critical. And it makes me think of a story. Maybe 10 years ago, I was out horseback riding with my daughter, who was at the time 4 or 5 years old. And the point of putting her on the horse was that she was going to have a great time, but that she was also going to learn about dealing with a horse. And the situation with a horse is that either you're in control of the horse, or the horse is in control of you, right?
Right.
And the same is true of heavy machinery, of so many different situations. Either you're in control of the situation, or the situation is in control of you. And the sooner, as writers, interviewers, whatever we do, that we recognize that we need to be in control. And this doesn't mean squashing things. This doesn't mean beating the horse. She wasn't being taught to hit the horse, and it did whatever she wanted it to do. But to very gently lead it to where she wanted to go. That's the secret. So that the horse actually thinks that it's going there on its own. But in fact, she's made it do it.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And Chris, I could talk to you forever, but in the little bit of time we have left, a few minutes, I would like to turn this over to people in the room who have questions for you.
Well, I'd be happy to take those questions, that I enjoyed it. Thank you for asking me to be back.
Chris, this is George in Michigan, and I understand that you have to do a lot of research and preparation, be prepared and all for interviewing and also with writing. Do you ever find it difficult in finding the information that you need or finding people to be uncooperative?
Oh, well, let's see. I think that absolutely people are not always going to want to answer the question you ask. So you get what you can from them and move on. There's no point in wasting your time, and if you know what you are about, you can find others who can help you. With research, we spoke earlier today about the abundance of information. I think the problem usually is not that you can't find enough information. The problem you have is in sorting it out. Really, that's up to you as a writer to make decisions about what's important and what's not important. And really, there's no wrong answer necessarily, but the wrong thing to do would be not to make any decision at all. Again, if you think about the end result, the reader is trusting you to make decisions. What's important? What's not important? What am I interested in? What's going to bore me? And so you have to decide. And so sometimes you just make the decision based on your gut.
This is Nancy Lynn. What was the most difficult interview you've ever encountered, and describe it, and how did you get out of it and save the day?
Oh, my goodness. The most difficult interview. I was a television reporter for WGBH in Boston, which people may recognize as the big public television station in Boston. And in the late 1980s, there was a nightly news show. And it wasn't a typical news show. You didn't chase after fires or that kind of thing. But one day, what I was asked to do was to kind of follow a fire story past the point of the coverage of the fire itself and look at what happens to the victims of the fire. Where do they go? How do they deal with losing their home? And so forth. And yet, it still began with the fact that I had to talk to people who had just been burned out of their home. That was very hard to do because you realized in a fashion that you were taking advantage of them. There they were at that moment. You know, it's probably one of the greatest catastrophes that could happen to anybody, to suddenly lose your home because of a fire. It's frightening, it's overwhelming, and everything else. I found it almost uncomfortable to have to speak with this person. And yet what I realized was that, well, here was an example for people to learn from. So, you know, I guess the answer to the question is I made the interview as short as I could. And then I left, and I went on and talked to the people who ran the shelter, and I talked to the people who were from the various agencies, and so forth and so on. But I didn't really dwell with the victim on their circumstances.
Amazingly enough, Chris, I lost a home in a fire, and one of the things that I yearned for, wanted very much, was for the media to do exactly what you just described. I wanted someone to care beyond the event. How was it that life was being put back together? Was it? And how effective were we in doing it?
Mm-hmm.
So it may have meant more to that person than you even know.
No, I don't know. But I do know that a friend of mine was studying to be a journalist, going way back. And she had to do an interview. She was assigned to do an interview with a family that had lost a young child in a terrible accident. And it was at that point that she realized she didn't really want to do this, you know? She just didn't want to do it. And she decided to, you know, she ended up in public relations because that was a little easier for her to take. It is a difficult job. Whether you're sticking a microphone under somebody's chin as a TV reporter, whether you're calling them on the telephone as a journalist, it is very difficult to get people at their worst moment and to make something of it.
Chris, this is Alan. I was just curious, what kind of maybe advice you would give to a brand new novelist or writer to get a publisher to take a chance on that person if they've never heard them before, if the writer is trying to get their very first book published. How do you get a publisher to take that chance on you?
Before, think about with the web, I think you probably have as good a chance as you ever did, perhaps even better. There are very easy ways today to begin a website, to have a blog, to do a podcast, to do the kinds of things that can show you off your ability, can attract a community, can make a case for you and the book that you're working on or the project you're working on. So if you had a story about your childhood or about the sports you played or about the subject that most intrigued you, and you showed that publisher that for the last year you have blogged on that topic day in and day out, and in the course of blogging on that topic have attracted so many readers to their site, that would be a very convincing argument. So, and on top of that, it would be a hell of a way to sell your book. Because not only are publishers looking, this is important, I think, to say, not only are publishers looking for people who are experts in their topic, but publishers are in business and they want to sell books. So if you come to them and you can say, I can all but guarantee you that the 1,000 people a day who read my blog, or whatever the number is, right, are going to buy a book, that's 1,000 books already sold. And I think that would be a great way to start.
Hi, we have a text question from Diana, and she wants to know, what are the common mistakes that writers make with publishers and agents?
Well, I'm not sure about common, but when it comes to looking for an agent, frankly and sadly, there are far too many people who are ready to take advantage of the fact that a lot of people would like to become writers. So there are agents who will charge you to read your manuscript. Do not work with any of these people. There is an organization called the Association of Authors Representatives, AAR. I believe that's what it's called. And maybe AAR.org or AAR.com. This is the kind of association of literary, and they all have to be members, have to ascribe to a whole group of principles, and one of which is that they do not charge to read your manuscript. They charge to sell it. That's important. But they don't charge to read it. So if you're looking for an agent and someone says, oh, I like what you wrote, but I need $200 up front to read the full manuscript. Don't work with that person. As far as publishers go, it would be hard to say any one thing in particular. Trust your instincts and check things out. There's a journalistic rule that I always tell people, you know, your mother says she loves you, check it out. If a publisher says, I love this manuscript, check it out. See whether or not they've published other books like it before. Go on their website, see what other kinds of books they publish. Try to do some research about them as a publisher, whether it's through Amazon.com or by going to the bookstore or whatever you choose to do, and find out how many books like this they've published before. Do you recognize any of the titles? These are the kinds of things you ought to do. If you find a publisher who loves what you do, that's a great thing. But as I say, your mother says she loves you, check it out. The publisher says they love the book, check it out.
Absolutely. That's wonderful advice, Chris. And unfortunately, our time is up, so I want to thank you for being here and would like to give you this opportunity to give your email address, should anyone wish to write.
Absolutely. And, talking to other writers is something I enjoy doing anyway, so perhaps there'll be a chance to come back and talk to your audience again about something particularly, and if they tell you they want to focus on something, I'm happy to do. anyone's welcome to write me. I'll give you my the easiest email address for me. I'm very lucky to have. It's Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at Keneally, K-E-N-N-E-A-L-L-Y.com. There is a website for my book, Massachusetts 101, and that's Massachusetts101.com. Made even easier because I have another website, the very same website, but different address, mass101.com. And you can also check out beyondthebook.com and write to me at, just if you write to beyondthebook@copyright.com, that will come to me.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And it's been wonderful having you. This has been a fund of information for all writers, I'm certain. Before we go, I'd like to give my email address for anyone who would like to write to me. It is bonnie@accessibleworld.org. That's bonnie@accessibleworld.org. I'd like to thank you all for being here tonight, and certainly would like to invite you to return next week when we get together once again for another edition of Books and Beyond. Good night.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.